Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, May 27th, 2025, we're delighted to host a program on Trump versus Big Law, discussing the law firm he owes and the associated litigation. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. And in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll introduce our moderator, and then I'll leave it to him to introduce the rest of our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Casey Mehta, who currently serves as Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together. Prior to joining Stand Together, Mr. Maddox's legal career focused on defending the First Amendment rights of students, faculty, healthcare workers, and religious organizations, which led him to litigate, in 35 states and testify several times for congressional committees. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kayla, and thank you to the Federalist Society. Thank you to the Free Speech and Election Law Working Group for making this possible as well. I am going to offer some very brief bios of each of our three panelists. As Kayla said, these will be much shorter than deserved. This is an impressive group of folks for a very important conversation about these executive orders and various actions taken by the administration addressing concerns the administration say have arisen because of the action of several law firms. We're going to begin with Aaron Murphy. Aaron is widely recognized as one of the nation's leading Supreme Court and appellate advocates as a partner at Clement and Murphy. She's argued dozens of cases in appellate and trial courts throughout the country, including the Supreme Court and nearly every federal court of appeals. She's also an adjunct professor at her alma mater, which is Georgetown University Law Center. And as may come up at some point during this conversation, she has previously worked for some large law firms of note prior to her current work defending one such firm. Michael Francisco is a public and commercial litigator with 1st and 14th PLLC. He has represented clients nationally for public interest litigation and a defense of constitutional rights, especially in the area of the First Amendment, where I believe we first crossed paths and worked alongside one another. Michael served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch and to Judge Timothy Temkovich of the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. Prior to joining 1st and 14th, Michael was himself in big law as a partner at McGuire Woods in Washington, D.C. And then Professor Derek Muller is a nationally recognized scholar in the field of election law and serves with me on the FedSoc Free Speech and Election Law Working Group. He's published more than two dozen academic works, and his op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. And importantly for this conversation, while he is also someone who has spent time in big law, and he previously published research on the ideological leanings of amicus engagement by some of the nation's largest law firms. So I'm excited to begin this conversation. We're going to start with Derek to kind of lay the groundwork, and then go to Aaron, and then to Michael. And I would ask, I believe, as Kayla mentioned, please do drop your questions. We already have a significant audience now. Please do drop your questions there. We will leave time for questions. And if the questions are even better, then we'll leave even more time. So drop your questions there, and I will feel no pressure to have to come up with good questions for this group. Derek, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Casey. Well, appreciate being here. This is great turnout. So I want to start just talking about some of the the nature of big law and the nature of its political and ideological polarization, especially over the last decade, something that I've been looking at and something I think that is an undercurrent in a lot of the executive orders. Now, obviously, the executive orders are touching on a lot of things. And Aaron and Michael, I know, will talk about those things, about, you know, racial diversity quotas in hiring practices and kinds of work that they choose to work on, whether it's pro bono or paying clients or whatever it might be. So lots of other things to talk about. There's no question that over the years, big law has increasingly moved to the political left. I started tracking about a decade ago some of the contributions from big law partners and associates from those who are employed at big law to the Romney and Obama campaigns. And while the overwhelming amount of those donations were the Obama campaigns, it was something around 3-1 Democrats to Republicans. As I looked at the first sort of salvo after the Trump administration, that had shifted more to 6-1 Democrats to Republicans from those who are employed by big law firms. And I'm working on updating some of that today. And it's probably going to be closer to 10-1 Democrats to Republicans in terms of the contributions. So it's a pretty significant shift in a relatively short period of time. And I think there's a reputation of big law maybe anchored 25 years ago to think that, well, they're defending large companies, Fortune 500 companies, fossil fuel companies, tobacco companies, and so maybe they're naturally gravitating toward more conservative causes. That doesn't appear to be the case. It appears to be that they're increasingly contributing to Democrats, and we can see all kinds of educational polarization that's happened in the electorate and probably just tracking a lot of those trends. But then one of the things I was also interested in is not just where they are individually contributing their dollars, where are they putting their work? Where are they putting efforts when it comes to these ideologically salient cases? So one of the studies that I did a couple of years ago was to look at amicus briefs filed in front of the United States Supreme Court. I took a 4-year period of time and said, where are big law firms filing amicus briefs and on whose behalf? And the way I did this, I kind of looked at a proxy to try to identify who were pro bono clients of the firm. That is, I think paid clients are different in kind from the pro bono work that firms do. The pro bono work reflects sort of the firm choosing to invest its resources. Often the firm very publicly indicates that it supports certain kinds of ideological causes and wants to make sure that it's identifying that in terms of its briefs and filings. So I found a proxy of trying to find nonprofits, scholars, academics, victims, survivors, those kinds of individuals who received representation from the AmLaw 100 law firms. And perhaps, again, no surprise that these briefs tended to code more liberal than conservative, probably about 3-2 or a ratio of liberal to conservative. Now, 3-2 is not that dramatic. Now, labeling things as liberal as conservative can be very complicated in front of the United States Supreme Court. There's lots of issues. There's procedural issues in addition to the underlying substantive issues. A lot of things, whether it's tax cases or ERISA cases, it might be harder to code or think about how significant those things are. But when you start breaking it down into those things that got the most attention, cases like Bostock, Dobbs, Bruin, those cases that got a lot of attention, whether it was sexual orientation cases, the Second Amendment, men, whatever they were, you immediately see that the largest law firms are overwhelmingly skewed in a liberal direction. About 95% of the amicus briefs in likely pro bono cases are filed on behalf of the liberal position in those extremely high salience cases. So despite the fact that it looks like there's some parity in some of the cases, it's overwhelmingly leaning toward one direction in those high salience cases. When you break it down by firm, the firms are actually a little bit more all over the map. Firms like Paul Weiss tended to be overwhelmingly on the liberal position. Covington & Burling, overwhelmingly in the liberal position. Some others, including Mayor Brown and including Baker Botts, Troutman Pepper, a little bit more balanced. So you had some different ideological positions from the firms in terms of their own work, filing these amicus briefs in front of the United States Supreme Court. Again, perhaps reflecting some idiosyncrasies of the firm, perhaps reflecting geography. If it's Texas-based firms that are maybe leaning a little bit more conservative than the DC and New York firms, a little bit more progressive. But I think there's this underlying question that even just identifying these trends in the research, there's underlying questions about why. What is driving these things? And there's lots of causes, and I want to just suggest a few of them, and I think we'll probably get to them as we start talking about the executive order and some of the motivations behind it. When firms make decisions to sort of stake their claim in certain places and say, we want to file on behalf of this cause or that cause, it's not sort of the firm as a firm, right? Corporations like this, so they're made up of people. They are made up of partners. They are made up of individuals who are making decisions. The pro bono committee is making a decision. So part of it is it reflects the ideological preferences of associates or partners who want to bring these clients in and want to file those briefs. But sometimes it's also a decision of the pro bono committee or a management committee to say, yes, we approve this. Or maybe the things that we don't see, no, we disapprove this. We don't want to weigh in a particular cause or in a particular direction. What motivates that? Is it because of the ideological leanings of the firm? Is it the ideological leanings of perhaps the associates at the firm and the partners want to make sure the associates are happy and they're not going to be disgruntled? Is it because the firms are making decisions that the clients want? And we saw a lot of this, I would say, after 2020 and the George Floyd protests and riots and the notion that there was going to be some racial justice kinds of claims that were raised. A lot of clients wanted to see firms do this and firms followed through and they filed those kinds of claims. So there's kind of a pendulum that might swing if we're thinking about it as being responsive to what clients' interests are as much as what the firms might want. And even within the firm, it can be complicated to measure as well. So there's lots of different moving pieces to try to figure out what's going on. But at a high level, I think there's no question in terms of political contributions and in terms of investment in pro bono resources. Over the last decade, we've seen an increasing trend toward liberal or democratic positions rather than conservative or Republican positions that's borne out in the data and the evidence, and I think has brought some of this friction with the current Trump administration and these largest law firms to a head in some of the recent executive orders. So that I'll stop. There's lots more to talk about, but I'm happy to hear from the others.
Well, thank you, Derek. It's a great sort of floor to begin the conversation. This is kind of where we were, the information we had prior to the first of the executive orders, right? Kind of the understanding of the kind of political leanings of these law firms, and we'll have the conversation here about just how much that is impacting this discussion as well. But Aaron, we'll turn to you and the executive orders that we've seen since February.
Sure, thanks. So, just before I get into the nuts and bolts of the orders, I just want to a lot of what Derek said is really interesting and definitely something I appreciate. I, as Casey alluded to, spent some time in big law and spent a good 5 or 6 years, fighting the good fight to get both my firm and be a model to try and get other firms to do, to diversify the work they did. And there were definitely areas where we had more success, areas where we had less success. And as probably some of you out there know, our law firm, Flement & Murphy, was born of a non-success in that respect. We ended up leaving our firm because the firm we were at was no longer willing to let us represent clients defending Second Amendment rights. And so that experience, though, is, having kind of lived through more than once the dynamics of people trying to kind of pressure lawyers not to do unpopular work is precisely why I find these executive orders actually extremely troubling, even though I can appreciate some of the dynamics in the background that frustrate people who look at firms and are more conservative and would love to see, as I would, more diversity among the firms in terms of the work they do. So I will disclose at the outset, I represent one of the law firms, WilmerHale, in this litigation, in challenging one of these executive orders. So for those of you who haven't had a chance to kind of really dig in and understand what these executive orders targeting law firms are and how they operate, there's a series of them. It started out with Perkins Coie, then Jenner, then WilmerHale, and then Sussman Godfrey, and a few other steps along the way. But they all follow kind of the same basic structure and setup. They begin with a section one of the order. They're all designed to say that they are addressing risks from a particular law firm and begin with a first section that basically says, here's kind of like my grievance with this law firm. It is very particularized, like you were associated with and hired back Robert Mueller, who I don't like. Sometimes talks about having done work in particular types of matters, having very politicized ways of framing the work, but basically saying you took a particular side in immigration work or in voting election law work or whatever it may be, and singling out, you have associations with lawyers I don't like for personal reasons that were involved in kind of typically had some connection to some sort of investigation into or litigation against President Trump. And you've done work that I don't like. And that's kind of the setup. And that's the risks we need to address from you as a law firm. You do things we don't like. And then you have this pretty extraordinary series of essentially sanctions against not just the firm, but also even designed to pressure clients to not work with the firm. So there's things targeted at the lawyers at the firm. Anybody with a security clearance, they're immediately suspended and subject to their own special review for whether you can get them back. Anybody who works at the firm, the government is not supposed to hire people into the Justice Department or otherwise who work at the firm without like special approval. So it basically creates almost, a very strong presumption against being able to work in government if you have worked at these law firms. There are restrictions on the ability of people at the firms to engage in practice restrictions. There was immediate instruction to all government agencies to limit access to government buildings and limit communications with attorneys at these firms. So basically saying we want to frustrate your ability to engage in the practice of law by the things that we all do day in and day out as lawyers, communicating with attorneys in the Justice Department, going to meetings there and at all sorts of different agencies. And then you have also this loosely connected idea of some of this having to do with government contracting, but it's not really targeted at particular government contracts that the law firms have with the federal government. It's not saying, hey, we don't want to hire you to do work for us anymore. It requires anybody who has a government contract and does any work with the law firm to disclose that, even if, and it says very clearly in these orders, even if the work that they do with the law firm has nothing to do with their government contract. It's just a way of saying, we want to know any government contract out there who does any work with these law firms, and then basically instructions to kind of shut down their government contracts if those government contractors don't end their relationships with their law firms. And so what you really have here is just this extraordinary set series of sanctions that are just designed to try to frustrate the ability of these firms to practice at all, to get their clients to fire them, to get their client to get others to not hire them. And this is all done very unabashedly and unapologetically designed to say the goal is to pressure you to not do certain work anymore. Now, that is again, from the perspective of somebody who's appreciated that dynamic in the private practice context, for that to come from the government is a pretty extraordinary thing. And we have challenged these. We've challenged an order on behalf of Wilmer Hale. Others have challenged them. And every challenge has so far resulted in immediate relief. And as to the ones that have been decided at this point, permanent relief on constitutional grounds. There's a number of claims raised in the cases, but there are kind of three core ones. The first, unsurprisingly, is First Amendment retaliation. It is just a well-established principle that even when you're operating in areas where the government could take certain actions, you can't do it to retaliate against people for engaging in speech that you don't like. And this is an area where we're just talking about core First Amendment activity everywhere you look. Lawyers engage in First Amendment activity when we are speaking on behalf of our clients. We are representing our clients' perspectives, our own perspectives, our firm's perspectives. It's speech everywhere you look. It's petitioning for purposes of the First Amendment as well. The ability to saying that you can't have access to the government, that you have to restrict access to government officials, government buildings. The whole point of that is to impede the ability to petition and to do the job of a lawyer, to make those, to engage in that kind of back and forth, which again, everywhere you look is kind of First Amendment activity, as Judge Bates said in his opinion the other day, entering a final judgment in the gender litigation. It doesn't even kind of matter if you think of it as the law firm's First Amendment activity, the clients, some combination of the two. The Supreme Court just a couple terms ago had a case that they unanimously ruled in favor of the NRA, NRA versus Vulo, where they said, look, you can't use the apparatus of government to try to use it to pressure people to not engage in speech, whether you're doing it directly against them or in sort of like a third party boycott type secondary boycott manner of saying we're going to pressure people who associate with the NRA is what was happening in that case to try to, you know, shut down their ability to do business. And that's exactly what was going on here. Retaliation. And really, you know, it is very viewpoint driven as well. It's having taken particular perspectives on behalf of particular types of clients in particular litigation. And that really gets to the second bucket of issues here, which is there's a very serious separation of powers concern here, that what you have is basically the executive branch trying to prevent litigation from getting to or having representation on both sides in the judiciary, before the judiciary. It's trying to hamstring the ability of the courts to hear from people on one side of a case, to have the best representation on both sides. And even in some of the language that we've seen in these orders or in defense of them, to try and prevent there from being litigation against the government at all. And that there's something problematic with law firms that sue the government. I mean, anybody who practices in DC, we sue the government for a living, no matter who's in government. It's very equal opportunity from that perspective. So there really is just a troubling, it's not as if we're talking about coming after these law firms because they engaged in some sort of litigation that was found to have been improper litigation or that the judiciary said there was misconduct. Many of these orders, what they're singling out is litigation where the law firm won. They did a great job. They were there, you know, whatever any of us think. Some of these are cases I was on the other side of. So, I mean, I appreciate the perspectives of all the litigation, but the concern is not, you know, you did something that the judiciary thinks is improper or anything like that. It's you represented a side we don't like. And that, again, you know, it not only goes to the core of kind of the First Amendment activity of a lawyer, it goes to the core of what we need to have our judicial function, judiciary function the way it's supposed to be. We're founded on the idea we want both sides to have the best representation possible, and that helps get the courts to the right results. And so trying to intentionally keep people from having representation on one side gets at that separation of powers concern. Just as much as the First Amendment. And then that ties into the third piece of it, which is the right to counsel. And there are multiple kind of strains of right to counsel protection within the Constitution. And this is designed to frustrate the ability of clients to pick their counsel of choice by saying, you know, if you associate with them, even if it has absolutely nothing to do with your government contract, we're gonna penalize you by taking it away. That is kind of your classic just secondary boycott behavior. And also saying, you know, you may have wanted to hire them, but any rational client is going to think twice about hiring a law firm if they're not allowed to enter government buildings and talk to government officials. It's trying to ensure that you can't have them as a choice, even if it's who as a client, it's the firm that they would like to have represent them. And so there's other kind of arguments around the edges, but to me, that's kind of the core and the core issues that the courts have focused on for the most part in the cases that have been litigated at this point. All of the cases at this point are that have been in district court, in DC district court, two of them have been litigated, two final judgment with decisions holding the executive orders unlawful in their entirety. The two others were our place included. We have preliminary relief and are waiting on final judgments. So we'll see what happens. You know, the judges who already gave preliminary relief seem to be pretty troubled by these orders. We haven't kind of heard yet what the government's next step is in terms of whether they're going to appeal. At some point, that decision will have to be made. But it's been really, really interesting litigation, and I really encourage everybody to take the time to get in and understand exactly what's going on with these orders. Because while I can appreciate as well as anyone some of the concerns that are out there about big law, this is just really not the way to go about dealing with them, consistent with the constitutional principles that I think we're all here talking about because we care deeply about.
All right. Well, Aaron, thank you very much. Mike, I suspect that Michael might have a different perspective on these executive orders. or at least on some of them, we'll see. But Michael, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and happy to be here and engage in this debate and provide a different perspective on the orders. I think just to add a little bit more background that's helpful before I get into some specific defense, there have been a number of law firms that have settled with the government in some fashion instead of facing this type of order or having one order rescinded, and those have also related to the potential Title VII investigations of those firms. So that would be Kirkland & Ellis, Latham & Watkins, A&O Sherman, Milbank, Cadwallader, Simpson and Thatcher, to name, I think, most of them. So they certainly found it easier to engage in a settlement than to litigate these particular issues. I think what's important to keep in mind here is that this is not a broad stroke attack on every lawyer who ever represented a Democrat. And the First Amendment issues are a close call, you might say, in some respects. And there are serious First Amendment concerns, but ultimately, I don't think that they apply or should be ultimately found meritorious as to most of the sections of the executive orders. The notion that this is a separation of powers or a right to counsel argument, I think, is really mistaken. I don't believe the right to counsel means the right to have one of six particular Am Law 20 law firms represent you at multiple thousands of dollars an hour. There is a right to counsel in the Constitution. That certainly is not the one I'm familiar with. Now, what's telling about this debate, of course, is that the way Trump implements this policy, he says the quiet part out loud. There's a lot of fanfare and distraction from some of the details of the policy. But what's the section that Aaron skipped over in her critique of the policies? That would be the section that has to do with racial discrimination in hiring and the potential investigation by the EEOC. And I will try to talk about the other sections in some detail, but I want to highlight that that section in particular is very understandable and defensible from the government's perspective. Now, maybe the law firms have a defense on the merits that their hiring policies or their set-asides, or if they're engaging in the equivalent of quotas, don't violate Title VII. But the notion that the executive branch can't direct the agency to investigate people for violating the law, including the law against racial and other forms of discrimination in employment, that's the bread and butter of what the executive branch does. Now, perhaps you say, well, this is First Amendment retaliation, but I don't think that the First Amendment gives these firms a pass for violating Title VII. Maybe they're not violating Title VII. That ultimately is going to be investigated by the EEOC, and I presume settled on the merits in the courts. But that's a very serious concern with law firms that doesn't fall under this political free speech retaliation rubric, at least not so easily, because most people understand and have long endorsed the executive branch enforcing racial discrimination laws in employment, including in this case against large law firm employers. Now, when we look at the other specifics of these executive orders, I think you will see that it's a little bit more bark than bite on some of the specifics. Take the security clearance review. Yes, it does direct that the security clearances of lawyers at these law firms would be revoked, but it's only basically a temporary action because it's revoked pending further review. And I'm quoting from the executive order language that's consistent with all the executive orders, pending a further review of whether such clearances are consistent with the national interest. So perhaps you don't like the fact that the security clearance is temporarily revoked without a full judicial process. But newsflash to those of you who don't have security clearances outside the government, you don't have due process rights to full judicial process with the security clearance. It's very much a privilege in the full prerogative of the executive branch to revoke or grant, and you don't have the ability to challenge that. And in this case, the revocation, it's not permanent. It's only until it's reviewed and decided whether it's consistent with the national interest. Not a large number of lawyers outside the government hold security clearances. I think for most of these large law firms, we're talking about dozens or fewer attorneys. And if you say the judges are right that these are the most abhorrent executive lawless orders you've ever seen, and they need to be restrained temporarily and permanently. Ask yourself that question. Should we have security clearances for lawyers that are not consistent with the national interest? I mean, that seems like the wrong result to me when you're talking about the executive branch allowing anybody to have a clearance outside the government. They should always be consistent with the national interest. And that's really the standard that is set forth in the executive orders. Granted, these executive orders are a little bit hard to parse in actuality because they've all been frozen largely or fully on a temporary basis. And so there hasn't been implementation on some of these concepts. So we're doing the best we can to understand what the government says in the particular orders. I've already talked about Section 4 on racial discrimination. I think that clearly has to be a lawful section of the executive orders. Otherwise, why is it that these six law firms are now exempt from having to comply with Title VII, but every other law firm in the Am Law 100 or 200 does have to comply with Title VII? I mean, surely the First Amendment doesn't give you a right to violate Title VII. I hope that's not the ultimate position of these law firms. In terms of the access to buildings, again, that was never really implemented. It called for there to be plans that would be developed. These executive orders are largely in the form of a press release. And I don't believe the government's position is that they're barring lawyers from going to main justice or going into courthouses. And it's much closer to saying that they're barring lawyers who don't have a security clearance or from one of these law firms from going into a SCIF or sensitive area. But in that sense, we may never know because they were frozen on this temporary basis. So ultimately, though, what you have here are executive orders that clearly are targeted to specific law firms. I don't think it is quite right to say that the president is simply saying that you took a side that I don't like, and that's why he's targeting these law firms. Fortunately or unfortunately, President Trump told us why he targeted these law firms. It's not because they took sides he doesn't like. Lots of law firms, probably every law firm, takes sides the president doesn't like. It starts with Perkins Coie. Okay, what is it that Perkins Coie did that got the president to say, I don't trust this law firm, they shouldn't have the privilege of having security clearances outside the government and having these other rights and privileges? And what they did, Perkins Coie, we all know this, it's well known. Mark Elias, when he was at Perkins Coie, paid for the Steele dossier with Clinton campaign money. He laundered that through the law firm, and then he used other lawyers at the firm to market this to the FBI to get Crossfire Hurricane started with the whole Russian collusion hoax. And that derailed the first 3 years, arguably, of Trump's presidency. Now, maybe you think that's fine, but I think that the president viewed it as beyond the pale and something quite different and more harmful to the country than just taking a side the president doesn't like. If you're counting at home, the conduct of Perkins Coie, I believe, clearly was a violation of campaign finance law. It was effectively laundering money to commit a violation of deceiving the FBI. That is the conduct that the president is upset about for most of these law firms. And then the other half of the law firms, he's talking about the Robert Mueller investigation and probe. Again, maybe you think that it's all fine conduct, but I just want to point out that it's something different than just saying the president says if a law firm represents a Democrat, they're not going to be allowed to participate in government contracts. It's much more specific than that in terms of who he is talking about it, focusing on these executive orders. And at the same time, it's more than just talking about the untrustworthiness of hiring these people or engaging in this conduct. He's saying that you need to comply with the law, including Title VII in Section 4 on the racial discrimination. And so ultimately, I think that the executive orders don't violate the First Amendment. They're understandable why they exist. There's a good basis for these sections, particularly the security clearance section and Section 4 on racial discrimination. And I don't see it as separation powers at issue at all. If anything, a judge telling the president that he can't suspend the security clearance of somebody outside the government is a much worse separation of powers concern than what we have here. And the right to counsel, again, you can hire other lawyers to do these jobs. You have a right to counsel. I think it is nearly offensive to the concept of lawyering to say that the right to counsel includes that you have to be able to hire Perkins Coie or Wilmer Hale on a private matter. You don't have that as a right to counsel in the Constitution. And I think I've probably said enough disagreeable things to move to questions.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Michael. All right, I'm going to ask this question this way, and this is probably getting ahead of the way that I would want to do this if this was a 3-hour conversation, because this would come toward the end, what comes next. But I think this is important enough that I want to go ahead and ask it now. How much is of this, and we'll take this response from any of the three of you. How much of this is unprecedented? How much of this is basically, as Michael said, saying the quiet part out loud, but is not really different from what prior administrations have done? And how much are you concerned, or what are ways that this might be setting potentially a precedent for a future administration that conservative organizations, conservative law firms need to be concerned about? So that's really kind of three questions in one, but I'll kind of toss it out there for your thoughts.
Sure. I mean, I'll certainly start and say I don't want to be a lawyer in a future administration where it's considered to be the norm to punish people who take on conservative causes. Like, that's an extraordinary, that is not, this is unprecedented to have the government come after lawyers. And so, I mean, it's not 100% unprecedented. It's precedented in the sense of we know about it from really bad examples in history when it's happened. But for the government to say, we're going to come after you because of what you do. And I appreciate, if this were a orders that said, we're going to focus on the couple of people who were involved in something that we thought were a problem, and we don't think those particular individuals should have a security clearance or whatever it may be. That's not how this operates. It says, Wilmer Hale, you welcomed Robert Mueller back. So every person in Wilmer Hale is subject to all of these restrictions. You might not even be a lawyer there, and you would lose your, you would have your security clearance suspended just by virtue of working at Wilmer Hale, even if you never touched anything, having anything to do with anything that the president is concerned about. And that's how all of this works, in this very across the board way that is just designed to say, we don't even want you associating, the very fact that you associate with a law firm that associates with particular clients is reason enough to impose all of these restrictions. That's an exceptional thing. And I don't think conservatives would fare super well in a legal system where that became the norm. I think that's exactly why, I appreciate it. We have been fighting this in other ways, or in more subtle ways, and not necessarily always government backed, but certainly aspects of pressure to not do certain work. I don't think all the big law firms necessarily are not wanting to do conservative work. There's different pressures. There's different people who are louder and push different buttons on all of that to try and get firms to do stuff. But to have the government itself come out and say, if you represent my people who ran against me in previous elections, if you represent, it doesn't take much for next time around it to be every firm that has done any work that is in support of Second Amendment rights, we think you are a threat to the national interest because of some of the people out there that have certain views about guns, and therefore you should all never work in government again. That's not the right thing to do, no matter which side of the ideological spectrum you're coming from on it.
Other thoughts from either Derek or Michael? Okay.
I'll jump in on, so thinking about some of the future or the longevity of these things. I think one of Michael's points is especially identifying the Title VII issues and the EEOC issues. And I think there have been a handful of firms focused on the national security or national security clearance kind of things, along with the specific clients or specific attorneys of the firm and those kinds of concerns. But there's also been a number of others, as Michael pointed out, who have settled And it's not clear that they were ever going to face the same kind of attacks on clients' national or security clearances and things like that. But they very likely would have faced the sort of Title VII investigations and the kind of concerns of the EEOC. So a number of these firms have promised, as a part of the quote unquote settlements, to offer pro bono services for a number of causes that the Trump administration prefers as part of the settlement agreement. So some of the terms, one of the things from Paul Weiss, causes that assist our nation's veterans, fairness in the justice system, combating anti-Semitism and other similar initiatives. So part of the settlements are pretty capacious. It's not clear what fairness in the justice system means or how that's supposed to be enforced. But it does allow some firms like Kirkland to ensure that the government is not going to come investigate them, at least indefinitely or temporarily or whatever it might be, on some of these other bases, and gives them the flexibility to sort of, whether it's relabel some of their existing pro bono efforts as meeting one of these definitions or encouraging associates in the way they were encouraged several years ago to think about racial justice pro bono projects, to think about moving in different directions for anti-Semitism or thinking about veterans affairs or whatever they are. So there is this sort of squeeze that has been happening with some of the law firms. I think to some degree, I think it would be a mistake to conflate what's happening with some of the firms with some of the public facing EO concerns that Aaron's identified that maybe have more First Amendment concerns related to them. But at the same time, it's not to say that these firms are all shaking in their boots in fear of shadows, right? Because I think there probably are some legitimate kinds of things that the EEOC is going to be looking at them for. And maybe the benefit of the bargain here is going to redound to their advantage at the end. But I guess that there's been a lot of debate about this, about firms capitulating or firms brokering deals on this front. To me, it's not clear that the deals are that onerous. And to me, there's probably more merit, at least to some aspect of the Trump administration coming after them. But I think there's also no question, as Michael points out, the Trump administration says the quiet part out loud, especially in Section 1, a lot of these orders. And that has, I think, created a lot of the most problematic positions in court in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts here. I'll try to keep it brief. Is this unprecedented? Well, in the exact form it is, perhaps unprecedented. But as Aaron said, she doesn't want the government to come after lawyers. Well, I'm sorry, that norm was already broken. What about Jeff Clark, who is being disbarred for providing a memo and advice to his client as a government attorney? And who are they going to go after in a future Democratic administration to similarly pressure the conservative big law firms? There are none. None. Derek's numbers don't even state the half of it. I'll just say the quiet part out loud. And everybody knows this. Big law firms aren't allowed to represent Republicans anymore. That is a change from how it used to be 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. There's no conservative law firm that a future Democratic administration could target in a similar fashion. They're going to issue an executive order against Consovoy McCarthy or First and 14th. Like, please be my guest. That would be great for business. So no, I'm not concerned about the rebound effect. All of the big law firms have already made their decision. Aaron's got her story about representing Second Amendment rights. I'm very sympathetic to that. But big law firms, none of them let people represent conservative causes. That is a dramatic change in my understanding of how big law firms have operated. And so, yeah, I'm not particularly concerned about the rebound effect, given what they've already done.
It seems to me once our defense is they did it first, that's not a great defense. It wasn't right, and it still isn't right. It doesn't get more right just because, now the shoe's on the other foot. I thought kind of the whole point in calling out abuses like that over the past few years has been to say that's not what we're not. Lawfare is not what we should be engaged in, and it's often raises a lot of really serious constitutional concerns. And I get the politics and the policies and that behind fighting lawfare with lawfare. But in the end, there are a lot of conservatives who would like to work in administrations in the future, and maybe not just in conservative administrations. We did used to have a time when people worked in bipartisan capacities and lots of different aspects of career positions in government, and all of this hurts, and it could hurt just because it's that it's the smaller firms that skew conservatives skew conservative at this point doesn't mean that there aren't ways that you could hurt people in the future, no matter which side they're on. And I guess in the end, though, the problem for me is just, you know, it seems like it just makes the polarization that much worse and pushes it all that much further, instead of looking for ways of how do we figure out what's at the root of how we have such different perspectives, you know, how we change so much. And it did change. I mean, when I started in big law, we did a lot of things at the firm that by the end we couldn't do. So I mean, I personally witnessed up front the change in kind of how much that shifted culturally. But I think that's starting, there's a little bit of that starting to push back. And I wonder and worry about whether some of this will actually stop what could have been a little bit more of an organic movement in, hey, maybe we went a little bit too far and need to balance firms out a little bit more in the end, because it is actually beneficial to big firms to have people at the firms who think differently, who have different types of connections in government, who understand how to work with different types of government lawyers. And the long term, that's in the client's interests, and firms do appreciate that. And that's what leads them to look for a little bit more diversity among the people they have that may be reflective in the work that they take on in the pro bono practices.
I want to start with a question we have in the chat, and please do keep adding your questions here. We only have 15 minutes, and there's a lot of very good questions already. But one person asked, I think, what is the fundamental issue with the executive specifying to executive agencies which law firms the agencies are authorized to hire or use in the executive agency mission? So just sort of looking at that aspect of these executive orders, the president says to the executive branch employees under his command, I don't want you to hire or work with these law firms. What's the response to that particular aspect of this? And Aaron, we can start with you.
Sure. So I think the important thing to understand is, as you know, Michael's absolutely correct, there's a lot of things the government can do, but they still can't do them for retaliatory purposes. So sometimes it's going to just depend on kind of what is, you know, do you have that section one? Do you have that? Here's why. That's where that NRA versus Rulo case from a couple of years ago is just really an important instructive case on all this, because that was a case where, so the NRA had said that the New York state government was basically going, you know, pressuring insurance companies to stop working with NRA in an effort to undermine the ability of NRA to do their work. And they brought a First Amendment retaliation claim. And in allowing it to go forward, the court accepted that, you know, they took as a given that there actually had been illegal insurance practices that the New York government was perfectly free to go after. But they said, you can't do it for retaliatory purposes. And that's true across a lot of areas. It's the same. I mean, there are principles in government contracting that you can't use the government's power of the purse in spending power and contracting to go to kind of engage in retaliation, viewpoint discrimination. Now, certainly you're going to have instances where there's government speech at issue and things like that. You know, so there's limitations on all of that. But the basic problem comes into play when the government, it's not necessarily what they're doing, but why they're doing it. And when you do say that quiet part out loud, it's an easy case. When you're saying, well, we're doing all these things, we're engaging in these investigations, we're using our leverage as the government to come after you because of your First Amendment activity, that's when the government starts to cross a line.
So I want to say that I don't think it's First Amendment activity that we're talking about here. And the law firms are trying to have their cake and eat it too. Every time a partner from one of these law firms is nominated as a federal judge, you can look up the receipts. They go to their confirmation hearing and they studiously say, oh no, I was just representing a client. That wasn't my speech. Those clients' positions in that case has nothing to do with reflecting my personal views. Okay, so they don't want it to be speech, and they don't attribute it to themselves when it's convenient. And now all of a sudden you're saying it is a First Amendment right to engage in speech activity or expressive activity when you represent clients. And obviously a lot of reasonable people disagree on this point, but I just don't see that as First Amendment activity. And that's why I'm not troubled by the executive orders. And I'll make just one example here. Let's say a lobbying firm, we'll call them Frake and Glamp, represented Saudi Arabia with regard to the Jamal Khashoggi affair. Are you really saying that the government can't dictate from the State Department that we don't want to have any contracts with this firm that represents Saudi Arabia because we've got security concerns? It's a trustworthiness issue. And again, I know that you want to frame it as a retaliatory free speech issue, but I think the quiet part out loud is the president saying he doesn't trust these law firms for the choices they've made on the people they've hired and the conduct that they've engaged in. And you might consider it First Amendment or expressive activity. I don't think it clearly is First Amendment expressive activity. And if it's not, what the government is doing here is just as unremarkable as if they said, we're not contracting with Saudi Arabia's law firm to do work at the State Department, which I assume nobody would challenge.
All right, we're going to move to another question. Feel free to respond in response to these. But we have a question from Eric Wesson, who I believe is the Solicitor General of Iowa, unless it's a different Eric Wesson. But Eric asks, in Congress's challenge to the Affordable Care Act, there was reporting that the executive branch had pressured Baker Hostetler and its clients to drop the case or drop the firm. So you had government pressure against both the firm and its clients. How is that distinguishable from this scenario? How much of that is basically a difference of Trump put it in an executive order suitable for framing? In these other situations there, and you know, stories with the use of the Southern Poverty Law Center list, for example, against people and organizations, that was that's different because it was quieter. Are these differences of kind, or are they better or worse that this is sort of out front in an executive order with sections that we can read and respond to?
I'll just note, I think there's always a challenge whenever government actors are kind of working or trying to work the refs behind the scenes, right? We saw this a little bit last year on some of these jawboning cases that went up the Supreme Court, but some challenges with standing issues. The Supreme Court didn't weigh in on them in the Murphy case. So we've seen situations where the government is working behind the scenes, putting pressure on people, or even not even pressure, but having lunch with friends at firms and saying, hey, what are you doing here? Do you need to do this? There's the question, though, behind all of those asks is like, what kind of threats are behind it? Or what are you going to do to sort of back that up? And what are the consequences for it? And again, this is two very different worldviews about how you interpret any one of these events. On the one hand, you're going to say, well, we know that the government's going to come at you softly. And if you don't respond, they're going to come at you with more and more force. And so implicit within that is a threat. So the soft powers being used, or the lunchtime conversation, are just an effort to get you to do something so the government doesn't have to go to that well to use those kinds of powers. But if the government never does those at the end of the day, is that a real threat? Or is that just sort of you projecting upon the government what you think is going to happen at the end of the day? But then there is something very formally different about putting those executive orders out there and that have a very immediate legal effect that lingers and has these consequences on these firms. So I don't have a great answer to identify the particular circumstances of Baker Hostetler. If it's a situation where they're coming at you with just like a generous ask from the government, you know, there are people that are going to construe that in many different ways, but it's not necessarily the same. It could be, but it's not necessarily the same as putting those executive orders out there. And I think it's really complicated, as we see in these jawboning cases and other kinds of cases in front of the court, about when the government is trying to use that soft power behind the scenes and never quite rising to that level of formality.
Yeah, and I would just, I mean, this is part of what, you know, retaliation cases are usually pretty hard to prove because, like, A, you don't usually just like declare your retaliatory intent. But it's not that, it's the combination here that you have the retaliatory intent with actual hard sanctions and things that are done to the firm. And that's as a legal matter, to prove a retaliation claim, you have to prove both the intent to retaliate tied to something so sufficiently coercive that it is going to kind of coerce the person of ordinary firmness to not engage, you know, to change their behavior, which, again, this is part of what makes this situation so extraordinary, is we have this real world illustration by virtue of the numerous law firms that in fact were coerced into changing their behavior and saying, we're going to settle and settle in a way where we say we're going to change the types of cases we bring, the types of litigation we handle, like we're going to change.
Yeah. But Aaron, how much of that is due because they're worried about their Title VII exposure for their employment policies? There's also reports these law firms, some of them that settled, have changed their practices. And so I think it's not as simple as saying that they're changing their pro bono representation when there's a real Title VII exposure issue that they're addressing.
If that were what it's about, they'd settle solely on the Title VII issues. I mean, the settlement it just what it seems to be driving this, and what is really the look. The firms are concerned about the rest of it. You can't operate. You can operate as a firm and defend your practices under Title VII, and you're going to win or you're going to lose. Nobody here is suggesting the government can't investigate Title VII practices. There are problems with investigating for retaliatory purposes and singling out particular firms because as a leverage against their speech. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the real threat to the firms here, the existential threat that leads them to litigate or to settle is you can't have a law firm and have a big practice where you can't engage with government, clearly enter government buildings, where any of your clients who have government contracts will lose them unless they fire you. Those are the things that make this, it's not just we're lawyers and we'll defend our practices just as we've defended our clients' practices under Title VII. Some of them will win, some of them will lose. It's this other stuff that is so exceptionally different. From simply saying we're going to investigate you under a particular statute and let the chips fall where they may.
I want to ask on the settlements themselves. So we have several of the law firms that have settled with the administration. And some people have raised the question if the law firm was posing a national security threat, but then a settlement that says you will dedicate a certain number of pro bono hours to certain types of causes. Was sufficient to eliminate the executive order. It seems to raise the question, what about the national security threat? And so I'll kind of toss that to anyone who wants to, maybe we'll start with Michael on this one. Does that undermine the asserted interests in a national security concern if you have a settlement that says, and then now, we're going to resolve that by this firm dedicating a certain number of hours of pro bono service?
Well, I think the president's always going to have national security concerns that are specific to circumstances in the future. But only one of the settlements had to do with a law firm that had an executive order issued. And so we're all frankly speculating on what national security concerns, if any, the president had about a firm like Kirkland. For instance, Kirkland didn't have an executive order issued. They just announced that they had reached an agreement with the president. So I that's actually true of all of them except the one settlement agreement. So I don't think it is particularly powerful, although it does apply to that one executive order.
All right, I'm gonna look. We could basically go all day long with this because frankly, there's all kinds of different directions we could go with these questions, and we're just limited by time. But I'm going to ask kind of a broader question here at the close. We began this with Derek talking about sort of the ideological valence among big law, and I think we have agreement amongst the panelists that the window has shifted leftward among big law over the last decade plus. We also have a number of folks, Michael and Aaron are both sort of refugees moving from big law into their own sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of conservative boutique law firm world. And there are a growing number of those. Is this good for the profession? This sort of shift from, where big law, I think, is perceived much more as on the left, but we have sort of conservative law firms that exist also. Is this good for the profession or bad for the profession as a whole?
I mean, I don't think it's great. Like as much as I think it's good to have, I love that there are more places that conservatives feel welcome and that there are so many great boutiques. That's a wonderful thing. And I love working at a boutique. And so it's a wonderful thing. But I don't think it should be your choice is to be, one ideological perspective and work in a small firm or another one, and lots of options, you know. And I don't think that's really true and fair, because I do think a lot of big firms are very welcoming to people with different perspectives. And that was one of the things I did a lot when I was at Kirkland. I worked really hard to just get it to be like, you don't have to be, you know, it's not like a dirty secret that you're conservative. Like, there are people here who have those views, lots of them, maybe people you didn't know had those views. And some of it is just getting people to realize it's okay. And that's sort of your first step to getting some cultural change in that respect too, is to realize actually, oh, turns out there's a lot more people at this firm that have different perspectives than I might have thought if all I did was, you know, look at how many cases they've filed on the conservative side of abortion or Second Amendment issues, you know. So I think it's important for everyone to have options in both big and small law. And so to me, it's not great for lawyers, and it's not great for clients to have, if you really have firms where people don't know how to think about it the way half the judiciary thinks about it. That's a disservice to your clients, no matter which side it is you don't have at your firm, of people who can kind of really understand the issue from through the eyes of somebody who may think differently than you do.
Yeah, I just want to say I agree. I think it's not great. I think we want to have opportunities for different kinds of firms, obviously large law firms and the small boutique firms. I think we've seen that growth in boutiques, as Aaron and Michael are testaments to, and the success of what those things look like. But it should be because of the choice that people have made, rather than feeling like they have to be, as in your words, Casey, refugees or escaping a place because they're unable to represent the kinds of clients or causes that they want at one at a particular type of firm.
Yeah, I mean, big law firms are friendly to conservative partners as long as you don't represent conservatives. That's the problem. And it is a problem. And it's a little bit beyond the scope of this panel. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about pro bono practices. And if you're a death row inmate, you can get one of 100 law firms to represent you very easily. If you're a January 6th defendant who engaged in nonviolent conduct on a very novel criminal theory, you can't get anybody to represent you. If you're an elector, like an old political stalwart who was told to do something by attorneys, an actual elector, and you've been prosecuted for a crime in Arizona, Michigan, or Georgia, you can't get a law firm to represent you either. Even if you have a conservative partner who wants to represent you, you can't get an Am Law 100 law firm to touch those cases. And that's not good for anybody when there's that much of a gap in the providing of legal services, which is, again, a little bit beyond the scope of these executive orders. But I think it's clearly a problem, and it's not going to be fixed by these orders going into effect, and it's not going to be fixed by these orders being frozen.
All right, well, thank you. And with that, Kayla, we'll welcome you back in to close this out. Thank you to Kayla for making this happen, and thank you to the Federalist Society and to our panel.
I will echo those thanks. Thank you so much to our panel for taking this time out of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. It was a fabulous discussion. Thanks also to our audience for joining us and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.